I sure hope you're hungry.
Ooh, I'm starving.
Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that old handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got a really good one for you today. We have Andrei Mashenko on from OpenAI. And kind of had like a friend of a friend introduce us. And I don't know a whole lot about, aside from the research I've done, but I thought it would be fun. Like, let's start off with the introduction. I asked ChatGPT to write an introduction for Andrei, and we'll see. I'm going to run through it and we'll see what he thinks of it. So today on the podcast, we're joined by Andrei Mashenko, an engineer at OpenAI who has made significant contributions to the development of some of the most cutting edge AI technologies. Andrei has worked on a range of products at OpenAI, including the development of GPT-3 language model and the optimization of neural network training and inference. He also has contributed to the development of OpenAI's research platform, which provides researchers with powerful tools and infrastructure for conducting large-scale experiments in AI. We're excited to have him on the show today to discuss his work and insights on the future of AI. Welcome. How was that?
That was pretty inaccurate, unfortunately. I don't know where it got all that information from.
It's funny because I asked it who you were, and it's like, I don't know. And then I was like, he works at OpenAI. He's like, okay, I got this. And it
just made the rest up.
Yeah.
Did you try with like the browsing plugin enabled, or the Bing plugin? Sorry.
No, I didn't actually. That probably would have been a much better, because I did go through the web and find out a lot about you, including the fact that you went to U of M. But why don't you give us a quick rundown of who you are and what you do at OpenAI?
I should say at this point, and maybe again later, that I do not speak for OpenAI. This is just like my own take on all of this stuff. Yeah, I am an engineer at OpenAI. I joined about 8 months ago, and I started the plugins project, so like the third-party plugins project in particular, a few months ago. I'd say that's the biggest thing I've done here. I've done a bunch of actually work on the AI research platform as well. ChatGPT did get that part right. Yeah, before coming here, I did a bunch of different things. I did a math PhD. I played poker for a year in Zurich, which was fun.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's, maybe we'll start there. That's kind of one thing I was interested in, is I went to your website and I found that you had done a bunch of algorithms. You had been involved in a bunch of papers around, what specifically was it? Like something with circles?
Circles, yeah, circles.
How can you explain what that is?
Circle packing is the area that I studied in grad school, and it studies, at a high level, it studies the sorts of patterns that you can form with just like round disks, circles, if you arrange them in certain patterns. Like if you start with a pattern, can you put circles in that pattern or not? And if you can, is the circle arrangement for that pattern unique? It's kind of hard without being able to draw it on a whiteboard or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually remember that years ago, I had to do what's called a box fitting algorithm, where we had like a bunch of like keywords, and basically some of the keywords, it's kind of like a tag cloud, you know, you want to be able to fit words into specific areas. And I got into it. I was like, man, that's complicated with boxes, let alone circles, you know?
No, we also see that you went to U of M. I'm also a Michigan grad, went to the School of Music. So go, little go blue off the top.
Go blue.
Yeah. Coincidentally, I'm wearing my Blind Pig t-shirt today. Just totally off the wall. Did not expect that. But yeah, so happy to have another Ann Arborite. Or are you originally from that area, or just it went to the school because it was Michigan?
I was born in Ukraine, actually, and grew up in New York and went to Michigan for grad school. I do love Ann Arbor, though. I have a lot of very good friends there and go back all the time. You know, Blind Pig almost closed during the pandemic. Apparently, it was like a grassroots effort that kept it up, kept it alive.
That's actually where this t-shirt is from, their grassroots effort to keep it up. So big fan. I actually played at the Blind Pig when I was a teen, so I have a... a big attachment to Blind Pig overall. It's just one of those institutions in my life. So you said you started at OpenAI when?
About 8 months ago in October, just a couple of months before ChatGPT went out.
Wow. And was your first project the plugin project, or did you work on other things before then?
My first project is an internal tool called CodeChat, which you can think of it as just like a simpler version of the ChatGPT UI that doesn't have a lot of the stuff that you need in prod, like scalability, telemetry, auth. It's just very, very thin, and it's a sort of playground for researchers to prototype new capabilities to be added to the model. So, for example, like code interpreter and browsing, and then also third-party plugins. All of those were initially prototyped in CodeChat and then sort of moved over to prod.
Oh, that's cool. I always wondered, like, how do you even test these type of thing? You know, like if you want the all of a sudden it can understand JavaScript or Python input, how does that work? Do you want to explain a little bit about how you implement that into ChatGPT?
Which thing? What would be the most fun to talk through?
Maybe let's just talk about like plugins in general. I guess that's something totally different, though, is it?
I think actually plugins is a good one to talk about. So
okay.
There's like different levels of the stack, and I guess I'll just like walk through a bunch of them. So
sure.
There's like the actual interface with the model. So the completion model takes strings in and gives strings back out. And in order to create the like conversational interface that ChatGPT has in it, where there's like messages in like a structured format, we take the set of messages that's in the conversation at any given moment, serialize them, so like stringify them basically somehow, like in some encoding format, send that to the model, and the model has been trained on a lot of conversations that are serialized in that format, and it knows how to produce sort of the next message in string format, and then we deserialize that back to get the next message to add to the conversation. So that part that covers like just having like a text message in, text message out conversation with the model. But then if you want to add plugins, you basically need to give the model access to another syntax that then we know how to parse and interpret. So the way that plugins actually works is that the model gets shown a function calling interface. So it gets shown a bunch of actually TypeScript function signatures. So in like a super simple example, it might get shown a TypeScript namespace called todo and a bunch of functions that are like add. And like the add function will have like a todo entry string field and then delete, which will have like a todo ID number field. So the model gets shown this list of function signatures. And then there's a syntax that we've taught it for how to compose a message calling one of those functions. We'll send the conversation so far serialized to the model and then get its response back in string form and deserialize that and parse it out and basically read out a function call in the format that we know or that we expect and then translate that and actually make the function call on the model's behalf. Add the results of the function call to the conversation and proceed forward like that.
That's awesome. Can we talk about a little bit of the model? I'm not sure how much of this space. You seem like a pretty smart guy, so I'm sure you can talk about it a little bit. But a lot of us developers are just using the API straight away, right? And then you hear about all these different models. How do you actually train this model that we're sending questions to? And how does the model actually understand the questions that we're asking and the ability to reply in natural language?
I mean, I'm not an expert in this, so
yeah.
I probably am not going to be able to say anything you haven't heard before. But
okay.
the way that I think of it is, like, fundamentally, it's a string completion model. So if there's a, you could think of it as like it gets a bunch of words and then it tries to predict what the next word is. So if it gets roses are red, violets are, and then you ask it like predict the next word, it doesn't just give you one word back. It gives you like a distribution over like what the most likely next words are going to be. And in that case, it's just going to predict blue. And that's basically it. That's like one of the two levels of training that there are. There's fine tuning and then something called RLHF, which I can tell you a little bit about afterward if you want. But most of what I think is viewed as intelligence in the model comes from the fine tuning phase. And I guess it's just sort of I don't know, a miracle, or I don't know what you call it, that like simply that very simple task of like learning to predict the next word is enough to get the model to implicitly learn all sorts of facts about the world, about the way that various words actually like interact and correlate. And so it ends up picking up concepts.
As it goes through, that's wild that it's like the answer to that is it kind of just learns, you know, like as predicts the next word to it.
And that process is all done through, like, what, a neural network? Is that the idea here? Is that the prediction is being done through a neural network?
Yeah, so there's like a giant neural network with billions of parameters, and you feed the initial chunk of text in, and then it sort of spits out the next word, and then the next one, and then the next one.
And that requires like extremely heavy computing, both for it to learn as well as to process it in real time. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Have you ever dipped into any of what that looks like? Like, I'm assuming it's a data center somewhere with a bunch of GPUs running.
I haven't personally been to the data centers where this stuff runs. I like SSH into the machines.
But. That's pretty cool. You could probably play Doom or something on those pretty smoothly, I bet.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about this RLHF and what that is?
So the basic way that RLHF works is that you train two models. One is called a reward model, and one is the actual model you're trying to train. And what the reward model does is, given like a completed string or a completed set of messages, it says how good or how bad that rollout is. And it sort of it just tries to estimate that. And the way that the reward model gets trained is with human feedback. That's what the HF and RLHF stands for. So basically, the base model will get used to generate conversations like over and over again for the same initial prompt. And then human raters will be asked, which of these do you prefer? And those ratings feed into the reward model. They like are used to train the reward model. And then so this reward model gets in, like what it learns is what humans like or what humans don't like, basically, which the string completion model doesn't really learn. Like just completing strings doesn't necessarily get you stuff that people like to hear or is going to be helpful. Like the string completion model is trained on the text of the internet. There's plenty of text on the internet that people don't actually really like.
Yeah. I bet. Okay. So it takes feedback. And where is that feedback generated from? Is it just things people find helpful? Like if I've uploaded something on Stack Overflow, would it take that into account? Or is it more like a thumbs up at the end of a chat window? I say, this was a good input or this was a bad input.
This is we have labelers that we contract to do these evaluations for us.
Okay.
So, like, we collect that data. We you know, could, for example, also use the thumbs up, thumbs down in ChatGPT in the UI.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether I'm allowed to talk about whether we do that or don't do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask, refrain from asking. I was going to ask if the thumbs down was wired up to nothing, like the elevator button. And, on YouTube, the thumbs down button is like not wired up to anything. It's just for people to feel good about clicking thumbs down.
That's not true, is it?
Is that really true? I didn't know that.
Well, what they did is
like a fake news rumor.
I think it is probably. But what they did is they stopped calculating essentially thumbs downs. I'm sure their algorithm behind the scenes utilizes them in some sort of way, but they only started showing positive feedback. So this now gets, 10,000 thumbs ups, and we're not going to let you know if there are thumbs downs for this at all. Where you used to be able to see the numbers back and forth, and people would make all kinds of plugins for that. So let's talk about plugins specifically, like maybe give them like an explain like I'm five for our audience, what plugins mean for ChatGPT. And then we can get into a little bit more of, how they can be used and things like that.
Yeah. So the third party plugin system is a mechanism for people to bring their product to ChatGPT and build integrations that users would access from the ChatGPT UI. So basically to add an integration into ChatGPT. The very, very basic way of thinking about it for our audience, since they're web developers, is to create a plugin, all you have to do is stand up a REST web server. And what the plugin system does is essentially you tell it what the API of your REST server is, and it gives the model the ability to like call your endpoints with whatever parameters your endpoints require. So if you have like a super simple REST API to like for a to-do app, say, I keep going back to to-do, like add to-do, yeah, delete to-do, then the model basically has access to that API. Or if you're like weather.com, maybe you have an endpoint to like get the weather based on geospatial location, then the model would see that API and basically be able to call it. So that's really the very, very basic capability that plugins exposes. It also supports things like auth.
Man, I'm looking at it right now. So Expedia is one of them. And I've got a flight coming up in a couple of days. And Expedia does not have anywhere on their website the ability to export to Google Calendar or to export your itinerary as a, like a calendar invite or log in with Google or anything like that. Like you have to like, sometimes it shows up in your Gmail and you can add it like that, but otherwise it doesn't work very well. And now I'm thinking I manually went in and added all my flights to my calendar with all the different time zones. But wouldn't it be awesome if you gave it access to Expedia, said, hey, pull a list of my upcoming flights and then format them as whatever the calendar ICNS, whatever the calendar extension is. That kind of stuff would be so helpful and probably would have saved me 20 minutes.
Yep.
Let's talk about the actual like code behind all this stuff. So when you're building day to day, what languages are you actually using to build this stuff?
Mostly Python, then React in the front end.
Okay. That seems to be that almost everything in the AI space is Python based. Is that because Python is very good at like data science and going fast, or why is Python the language for the AI space?
It's just because that's what people use and what people love, or I don't know if they love it, but it's what everyone uses. So all the major ML frameworks have Python client implementations, and it's a great language to get started on and spun up on. It's like very easy to get started. Integrates really well with C, so for the parts of your code that you do need to be performant, you can like escape hatch out to C or another compiled language.
That's cool. We have somebody coming on the show in a couple of weeks who's working on like a new Python interpreter. Or no, sorry, it's from a company called Modular. And they're working on like basically a compiled version of Python so that you can still write all of your ML stuff, but it'll run in assembly code instead of actually having to be interpreted as Python. Seems pretty nifty. I'm excited to have them on.
Yeah, that's cool. Probably not possible to be fully language conformant.
No, because why is that?
Python lets you do so much dynamically at runtime with like mm-hmm. the things that in your program that appear to be statically defined that for performance reasons you would want to compile into your binary. Like you can edit functions and class definitions at runtime, technically, or even like module symbol tables. Yeah, it just seems like if you tried to compile it and you actually wanted to support the standard, you would end up having to like run an interpreter inside of your compiled binary.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. We actually had that. We were talking about that. We're mostly JavaScript devs, and we had that the other day where people were complaining that like if you want to ship, at least right now, if you want to ship JavaScript, you have to ship the entire kitchen with it, right? The whole runtime to actually make it work.
And the entire TypeScript kitchen as well, right? Not just the JavaScript kitchen.
If you want to be able to convert it from TypeScript, people are like, oh, why can't you compile it to assembly code? And it because of reasons like that. You can literally monkey patch a function in the middle of running it and change what the functionality is. Probably shouldn't, but that's the dynamic nature of it.
Doesn't TypeScript get stripped out at compile time?
Yeah, the TypeScript does, but there is a runtime called Dino that we often use, which will it strips it out at runtime rather than you having to compile it out.
But there's also source maps and stuff. I mean, you're not shipping those to the client, but you're shipping them in libraries and stuff. When you, because you mentioned that you started on right before ChatGPT was available to the public. Was that what you had mentioned?
About 2 months before.
When that like time period was going on, did you have any idea that when it was released, it was going to blow up the way it has in the popular culture sort of way?
No, I don't think anybody did actually. Even internally.
That's wild to hear because like I'm sure like the AI space has been going on for many, many years, right? And then it just seems like us normies are starting to get excited about it because it's accessible. It's cheap for us to get into it. I can write a fetch function and hit the API and be an AI developer at the end of the day. What was it like internally when this stuff started to just blow up? Was it kind of like all hands on deck to be able to make this thing work?
Well, when it was blowing up, the team that was running it was definitely all hands on deck to like keep up with the growth. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I would say it was definitely a change to the culture internally when suddenly we had this like extremely popular product that like many, many people around the world were using. Like we weren't really a consumer product company prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there was a ton of attention. Like when I joined the company, no one that I talked to outside of like the AI and computer science community like really knew what OpenAI was, or at least like many people didn't. And now like everyone does. And that was a big change.
Yeah, it really did seem like there was a few APIs that people had at least heard of, but even, you know, ChatGPT is making the rounds as ChatGPT. And maybe people aren't even talking about OpenAI as a company necessarily, or as the parent of all this thing, besides the website you go to for access to ChatGPT or something. Did your background in math like really lead you into where you are in your development career, so to say? Because I went to school for performing arts, essentially, at Michigan. And sure enough, I talk into a microphone all day, but I'm a developer, right? And for me, I wouldn't say necessarily that my degree has led me here, but I use my skills all the time. Was your degree and your work in the math field actually one of those things that has carried you through into your development career?
I would say that like a rigorous math education is really good for like thinking rigorously and carefully through technical stuff. I don't know if I would always have been that kind of person, whether or not I had done the math degree. I think a lot of what math teaches you actually is vocabulary. And actually this ties back in an interesting way, in my opinion, to language models. Or if you think about programming, right? Like why do we write functions and classes and like higher level abstractions? It's because if you were just like working with the base level abstraction all the time in one big flat imperative loop, that would be like too much complexity to manage. So we like bundle abstractions that are, you know, useful abstractions in the context of where we're working. And then we think in a higher level in terms of those abstractions. And that's what math is all about.
And I think about that all the time, anytime I watch videos on the higher level math concepts, where it's just abstracting away math into essentially symbols. And before it gets too long, I have no idea personally what I'm looking at, because the highest I went in math was Calc 3. So for me, I'm looking at those symbols just like, I don't know about this stuff. So, you know, it does really resemble programming in a lot of ways. And like you mentioned, abstractions.
Yeah, I don't know. I just like thinking in abstractions, though. Like, that's why I liked math, and that's why I like programming. I don't really see a lot of, like, direct carryover, if I'm really being honest with myself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Where did you learn to program, then? Did you also take a comp sci degree, or did you just pick up Python? Or is that part of a math degree? Is that your programming?
These days, it probably is kind of part of a math degree, but I finished my PhD in 2012, so kind of a long time ago now.
Okay.
Actually, when I went to high school, I went to a magnet school in New York, and this was I started high school in 2000, and this was before high schools really had CS departments, or at least it was pretty uncommon. Now I guess they like all do, but actually we had this guy, Mike Zemanski, who was awesome, who started a CS program at that school, and he was like a former Goldman software engineer who like rage quit Goldman and came and decided to teach high school computer science. So he had us doing things like building ray tracers and writing web servers and building like shells. And we were maintaining the school's computer networks, like all these Debian boxes. So I was doing all that stuff even back in high school and getting into programming and computers. And then when I went to school, I didn't really study CS. I like took a math class and really liked it. Like a particular math class called set theory. And I just said, oh, this is awesome. And then in the spur of the moment, I just put math instead of CS down on the line where it says major on the form, the entry form to school.
That's wild. I'm curious what the demand for math majors will be now that a lot of this AI stuff is really starting to pick up. Because like I talk to folks that are just at random companies and they're starting to hire people that know this type of stuff, because you can only NPM install so many algorithms before somebody has to make a middle out algorithm by themselves or something like that, you know?
People in tech companies, or at least many tech companies, like to hire math majors because you don't study math to like get rich generally. Like the people that are studying math are the people that like really love math or like thinking in abstract terms or solving technical puzzles. And it turns out a lot of that is very transferable to engineering work, software work, but also ML work. So I think my friends from the math programs that I've been in, they seem to do okay in the tech sector.
What other kinds of stuff are math grads working on?
People used to go into consulting a good amount, like McKinsey, BCG. I think lately that's been a little bit less the case. These days, it's really a lot of people going to places like, you know, Google and other tech companies. People do go to places like Goldman or like other hedge funds on Wall Street. A lot of people go into things like teaching. Obviously, a lot of people try to be professors.
Yeah.
But it's really hard. It's like insanely competitive.
And like a lot of these big companies are hiring math folks so they can create algorithms or processes to find stuff that we would otherwise not be able to find just by like I know like a lot of my friends from school went into working at KPMG and stuff like that, and they would evaluate big spreadsheets and try to find, just by their own smarts, they would try to look at the data and then make recommendations. And I'm thinking like, boy, some of those folks are going to be out of luck because AI is really good at that.
Yeah, really good with lots of data. Yeah,
you can upload like a spreadsheet of your data and it will find like occurrences. Like what will that do?
I don't know.
I guess it's just like, it'll find like trends and whatnot within the data. And I think some of my poor friends in working for these consultancies are going to be out of job.
Like I do think learning to leverage the model for what it's really good at and learning to continue to do the stuff that it's not great at and that you are really good at is going to be an important thing as we transition over the next few years. So like, I definitely use Copilot heavily, for example, when I'm writing code. Mm-hmm. And it's changed the way I write code. And it's like changed the things that I focus on. It hasn't made it so that I don't have to write code anymore. Actually, I probably spend a smaller portion of my time actually with hands on keyboard, like typing code in, and more of my time like thinking about how I want the code to be structured and then like guiding Copilot to fill it in. And I think with your example with spreadsheets, it's going to be similar. Like getting an answer to like what are a couple of patterns in this spreadsheet, suddenly that'll be a fairly quick thing to do. But then there will be like way more spreadsheets. There's always more data. It's like, where do you look? Where do you focus your attention? What questions do you ask? The work just sort of shifts.
Yeah, that's one thing we were talking about as well. A lot of people are like, I'm joking about like, are we going to be out of a job? But certainly the type of work is going to be changing, given that we're not figuring out how to center a button anymore. But now we're freed up from that work and we have to think about larger, more complicated things at a larger scale. So that's kind of interesting. I also wanted to ask you.
But before that, do you guys worry that you're about to be out of a job?
No, I honestly see this stuff as a massive like booster pack in terms of what we can get done, because a lot of people are looking at it like, okay, let's just stay where we are with technology, but AI is going to do that for us. And then we're just going to have a 2-day work week or something like that. And unfortunately, that's not how it works. Is if we can get this AI to do a lot of the work that is sort of the heavy lifting and whatnot, then we are then freed up and we have the superpower of being able to do more complicated stuff. And I feel like we're going to see a major jump in technology in the next couple of years. I'm not sure what you think about that.
Yeah. And I personally too, like Wes, you know, I spend more time thinking about conceptual things rather than the technical details. Like I've been working in NoSQL databases for so long now. And now that I have a MySQL database as my main stack, I don't have to worry about the fact that I haven't been working in MySQL for so many years. I can find the answers to the questions I have of what I'm doing at any particular time way faster and worry about the conceptual things instead of the nitty gritty of each individual thing that I'm doing. And I'm still having to generate the big questions rather than just outputting, you know, my entire app for me. I'm still having to direct exactly what I want at all given times.
You don't worry that it's going to get better and better and that even the things you're doing now, you won't have to do anymore?
Yeah, that's the question.
Sure.
Is,
yeah.
Oh yeah, I'm really good at it.
That's the question.
That's what people are like, I'm a prompt engineer. And it's like, well, you know who also is a good prompt engineer? The AI.
GPT-4.
Yeah.
Right, exactly, right.
You know, it's like this, it's this circle of, well, if you can do it, can't the AI do that as well? And at a certain point, I don't know, like, do you foresee any time where we are going to be out of work, or maybe any industries that are just going to be decimated?
I should say at this point, and maybe again later, that I do not speak for OpenAI.
Yes.
This is just like my own take on all of this stuff. I think that like there definitely will be categories of labor that the AI will just do for us. And like, you know, when computers were first a thing, there were these rooms full of people, you know, hacking on punch cards with like their bare hands, right? And like, we don't do that anymore. We don't do arithmetic anymore because computers can do arithmetic for us. And there will be things like that that LLMs also automate. And I don't really want to speculate about exactly what those are. And like, of course, like the day-to-day jobs will shift over time. What will people do as more and more work gets automated? I don't know. I think it's a little bit unclear. I think like an optimistic future that I've personally started to think about is that people will start focusing on crafts that don't scale, like build my own home the way that I want it to look, like tend to a garden, cook really good food, you know, brew nice beer, serve it to people, things like that. Things that, you know, might not make economic sense to fully automate away. Do woodworking, write a poem. I guess GPT-4 is pretty good at writing poems.
Yeah, poem. Right, yeah. Well, that's really interesting. I've made the joke before that there's going to be like Etsy coders that I'll code it by hand. You know, like I'm not using
handcrafted
any AI.
Code.
Exactly, handcrafted from like with a beard and all that good stuff. But it is actually interesting that it could be, yeah, focus on stuff that doesn't scale. I've never actually thought about that before.
As someone who works in the space, does it get tiring to hear the LOL people will lose their jobs or my everybody's jobs is toast kind of deal? Like, is that tiring to hear over and over again?
Yes and no. Honestly, I don't personally follow the news. Like, I don't read Hacker News or Twitter. So I guess I just don't hear the volume of that someone would if they were following those things actively. Like, I don't read Reddit, for example.
It's probably smart on all accounts.
That's good. We get a lot of questions from people who are 1 to 2 years in on their web development career. And they're like, should I like ditch this right now? Should I go learn plumbing or something like that? And then, or farming. And it's hilarious because I was like, my brother-in-law is a farmer and this stuff is shaking that up just as much as it is your HTML over there. So I don't think there's very many industries that are going to not be affected by this.
How is his farming being shaken up? Just curious about that.
There's so many things. Like, there are lasers that can, like, literally laser beams that can shoot weeds. So instead of spraying, or it can just spray like pesticides, instead of spraying everything with a pesticide, it can have a camera and detect what the weeds are and just pew, 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 like hit them out of the air because you have 6 billion images of what a weed looks like. It's able to detect the weeds and quickly zap them out. So there's kind of interesting stuff like that. And then like there's also the like self-driving robots. These tractors are like $1 million and they're huge, like, I don't know, 50 feet wide. And then they're really heavy and it impacts the soil. You have lots of compaction. So they're saying like, what happens if we just have like 20 of these tiny little robots that do the farming instead of one major one, you know, like there's a lot that is happening and they already have GPS guided systems that will plant their their rows perfectly straight. So there's a lot of shakeup in that industry as well.
At the same time, farming is an interesting example because it used to be, you know, 70, 80, 90% of the workforce, and now it's really a tiny portion. It's in some sense, farming has already been shaken up by technology.
Yeah, it's true. It's been around for a while. What do you think about like the 2-year curve of this type of stuff? Do you foresee it going at the pace that we're currently seeing, how quickly things have gone? It feels like the last 6 months, a year has been a whirlwind. Is that going to keep going at that process? Is it going to level off? Do you have any idea?
I think the future is uncertain.
Yeah.
I do think there's a lot of stuff that's going to come in the wake of people building better plugins or like tool integrations, basically.
Yeah. Do you foresee the plugin interface being a big, big shift in how people use these tools?
Again, not speaking for OpenAI, but just for myself. If I think about like what is the interface that I want to do a large class of interactions that I do with my mobile device or my computer, I would like to just be able to like speak to my phone and say, I'm having a party tonight. Can you make sure there's a large pepperoni pizza and like a 6-pack or whatever at 7 o'clock? And I want the phone to just respond to me and say, okay, I know that you like this pizza place. Here's the order. Is that okay? And I say, yes, okay. Basically like an Alexa, but it works, or like a Siri, but it works kind of interaction. And plugins, it's basically just like the interface that allows people to build those kinds of interactions with the model. Like if you're a food delivery company, you can expose that interface of like get menu, like add item to order, finalize order. And it's still in early days. But that's the direction I see things going, just because like that's the interface that I think users will want. That's the interface that I would want. And technically, I think with the LLMs getting as good as they are now, that's actually buildable. Like that's not a very intellectually demanding task if you think about it. It's really just like teaching the model a few very basic flows of like how it should navigate that kind of an interaction with a user, that kind of a conversation.
What about that thought, but on programming? Do you think that we will still be writing Python and JavaScript to build these types of things? Or do you think that we're going to be writing some sort of higher level abstracted? Because right now, a lot of these tools are just, we talked to the guys from GitHub Copilot a couple days ago. They said, these are just bolted on solutions. This is how we do things now. How do we add AI into it? But then they're also thinking about like, what if we did something totally different? Do you foresee that ever happening with code?
Well, when you're thinking about how to make it easier to write a program, like you have your you want your program to do XYZ thing. How do you implement it? There's two angles you can attack from. One is you can increase the quality of your abstractions to make the program just easier to write. So you can build higher and higher level abstractions. The web sees a ton of this, right? Like we have TypeScript, we have React on top of TypeScript, on top of JavaScript. And then you have, you know, React libraries on top of that. Or the other thing you can do is have an engine that like auto-generates the code for you. And working on those two things is like a little bit orthogonal. So like, I think we're constantly trying to make our abstractions better and better. Like it's way easier to just like build a basic web page with like a button that does, you know, something when you click on it today than it was even 10 years ago. And like in that question of like, are we still going to be writing JavaScript and Python? It's sort of implicit, like, can we come up with higher level abstractions? Like what you're really asking if you ask whether we are going to keep writing JavaScript and Python is, can we make our abstractions even better? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that, I'm a little bit more skeptical. Like there's a lot of companies trying to do this with like no code or low code stuff. And that's basically what that angle is. And I think that there's a reason that very few really professional enterprises use no-code solutions for their prod software. You actually want to have your hands on all of the low-level knobs to like really tune the behavior of your application. What the LLM does is allows you to attack from the other side of like making the process of auto-generating that code that can't be abstracted. Like you need to like spell it all out. Mm-hmm. But it is pattern matchy enough that like a pattern matching engine like the LLM can do a lot of work helping you auto-generate it. So yeah, TLDR, yes, I think like programming languages are still going to be around because it's nice to specify things formally. the LLM will continue to get better at helping you use programming languages.
That's good. And do you foresee a future where AI will give us more expected outputs? Like in math, 1 + 1 = 2. In programming, we have pure functions. And part of the frustrating thing for developers working with these things is you don't always get the same output. Do you foresee a future where we will be able to get reproducible outputs given the same inputs?
Well, you can do that now, actually, by like, I'm not sure whether that's possible with OpenAI's public API, but you can configure the model to always give you the same thing back. I think the randomness is actually a feature, not a bug.
Oh, okay. Is that what seeds are?
Yeah, seeds and like temperature. So like what the model actually produces in its like string to string completion form isn't like the next string. It's like a probability distribution over the next string or the next like word, say, next token, really.
Okay.
So there's like, the next token could be anything, but like this token is more likely than that one. So like, what is the likelihood of each of the possible next tokens? And then you just sort of, you could either sample according to that distribution or you can just take the most likely one.
Oh, I see. So it is the mathematic output is always the same. It's just the fact that it's different every time is a feature of people wanting that to be.
It's more natural, right?
Yeah, exactly. I
mean, it's natural language. You had mentioned, you know, utilizing these tools for what they're good at. But I before, you know, we wrap up or anything like that, I did want, you know, for the audience, people who might not be that up on the latest or even deep into this stuff, like what do these things do better than anything else?
Language and pattern matching.
So just, yeah, pattern matching.
Really, it's language. The way I think of like the LLMs are going to be useful for a lot of stuff, but they like smooth the transition between natural language and formal language. So that's like why the LLM is able to write code for you. But also if you have a DSL that exposes like the set of functions to control the lights in your house, that's a formal language, right? In order to use that interface, you need to like call the function syntactically correctly. The LLM can just do that. And that's the plugin system. And you can imagine like, if you're, you know, Microsoft and you have Excel, you can expose some like formal DSL that controls Excel or like controls like what to add to like how to configure the function that's going to be computing the value of some cell or, I don't know, resizing a column or something like that. And then in response to like a user command given in natural language, actually execute like the correct formal language instruction to make that happen and do it in a way that's actually reliable enough for consumers. To me, that's like the immediate superpower of LLMs. Now, the real goal of OpenAI is to build AGI, whether LLMs are obviously going to be an important part of that. And I think there's like some debate over whether you'll need more than just like a pure language model, or like if you keep making the language model bigger and bigger and give it more and more data, can that scale all the way up to AGI?
What can you explain what AGI is?
AGI stands for Artificial General Intelligence. And we have a definition of that in our charter, but off the top of my head, I think it's defined to be an autonomous system that's as good or better than humans at all economically relevant tasks. So basically an autonomous system that is like better than any programmer at like making some website for some company or analyzing, you know, a stock portfolio,
yeah,
or diagnosing a disease.
What on a personal level, what's your favorite AI-based tool or project going on right now?
Other than plugins, which everyone should go and
yeah, right. Other than your own stuff, yeah.
I like Copilot a lot. Copilot's definitely changed the way I code, as I said.
Definitely. I just got access to the Copilot chat this morning. I think they announced it this morning at Microsoft's dev event. It's wild. It's the contexts are getting big. Actually, man, that's something we haven't even talked about, is the context of the number of tokens that you can give it is getting larger and larger. And then the new chat is able to, they haven't said what it is, but it feels like it's reading more of your open files and passing more data to it. Like I was able to get it to give me a response that was about 7,000 tokens, I think, which is still under GPT-4, but pretty large.
It gave you a response that was 7,000 tokens?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. I was trying to measure it. It was because I was like, give me, I gave it, I say, generate some types. Give me a list of people. Each person has a job. Every job will have a manager, a start date, maybe an end date. Give me types, 50 or 20 examples, and write a library for it with documentation. And it went through the whole thing. And I tried pushing it up a little higher, and it started to just do dot, 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 insert your data here. But I was pretty impressed with it.
It's cool.
Something in your real life. It must be wild working in this every day and then having to go back to normal life. And I call people on the phone and it's like, press one for X, Y, or Z. Press two for, and it must drive you nuts seeing all these things in the world that could be so much better solved. Are there any examples in your life that you feel like you cannot wait for AI to get a hold of?
I guess like customer support lines.
Yeah.
And like, although we'll see. Right now, when you get a bot answering you on the phone, you're not like happy usually, right? It's like, it doesn't bode well. I guess we're hoping we can change that.
But that was the big thing a couple of years ago with the intercom. They had chatbots and I would get so frustrated with them because they never actually know what you're talking about. And it feels like they're just piping it into some knowledge base, but maybe better now.
Yeah, well, it ends up being like a contact form with more steps. Here, I've written out this big chat. All right, what's your email? Okay, this is a contact form.
They're just trying to get you to not contact them. But like Netlify, so Netlify is like a host. What they did is they took all their docs and every single form post and whatever else, and they ran that through, I'm assuming they ran it through embeddings. And I asked it a couple questions of things I've had problems with on Netlify, and it came up with the right answer every single time. And I was pretty impressed by that. I was like, that is way better than me going through support, because the support would have had to find the person that knows about that specific area of serverless functions. And I said, this is a really good example of customer service, not trying to shoo me away from contacting them, but trying to help me faster than contacting customer service.
Yeah. What about like doing taxes? Like, have you ever tried to read the tax code or like the instructions for filing taxes?
Yeah. That's a good example. It's like, what am I allowed to do? Or
like, I'd love to be able, actually the tax code is not natural language. It's basically its own little formal language.
Yeah.
So I'd like to be able to use the model to translate my natural language query of like, do I have to file this form or not into, like it can read the tax code for me and actually give me a reliable answer. That would be great.
Yeah, I was just using ChatGPT for something the other day on my business side of things, asking it questions. Which forms do I file in Colorado? And the amount the type of ease that it was able to say, here are the forms that you file, you know. And it's not like I want to just blindly trust it. I want to, you know, verify everything, obviously. But I just find those types of interactions in the mundane stuff. I'm going to have to go hunting on your government's website. The government's websites are all bad. You have to like paw through them to find the right forms. And, you know, being able to use these tools in that sort of way just does feel like a big upgrade. It would be nice to pass in all of your financial information and say, hey, where am I? What am I missing out here? Like there's, the research and development credit. You are not taking advantage of that. File for that, you know. That really seems nice.
Here's hoping.
Yeah, we had some lawyers on a couple episodes ago, and they were like, no, the AI stuff is cool, but you still need a lawyer to make sure you cover everything. And I wanted to be like, well, like at a certain point, the AI is going to have a better understanding of all of the laws in your obscure state or like county laws than a lawyer might, you know. Like I'm not saying it's going to replace them, but certainly helpful.
I feel like a lot of what lawyers do is have relationships with like the judges and various people in the legal system as well.
Oh man, I watched we don't have sick picks right now, but I just got finished the Murdoch murders on Netflix. That was very, very good. It's about have you seen that, Scott?
I listened to some podcast about like the exact same story. Like,
I had never heard of it.
I'm very briefed, but we did watch the Netflix one as well because, you know, Netflix.
All right. We're going to get into the next section of the episode just before we wrap it up here, which is our Supper Club questions. These are questions that we ask everybody who comes on the show. The first question we have here is what text editor And terminal are you using?
I used vanilla Vim for a really long time. And then I tried NeoVim for a bit. I went through a phase of configuring it endlessly. Now I just use VS Code. And I use like Kitty and like various other fancy terminals. Now I just use iTerm. I gave up configuring everything endlessly. No more.
That seems to be such a common response on these, especially as the like the smarter the guest we have, they're just like, I just use the default, you know?
I used to like remap my keyboard and like futz around with like what my semicolon key does and what my left brace key does, remap the whole thing. Now I just, everything default.
We remap our caps lock key, both of us, which is
caps lock is control. I assume.
There you go. Yeah, I actually use it for hyper. So it sends shift, control, option, and command at once. And then you have a whole new set of keys available to you.
What do you use Hyper for?
Or I have it paired to all my window management for recording. So I can just hit my Hyper arrows and it will boop, 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 do all my things. And then I
do the same, man.
Lots of just like shortcuts for development. Filling out credit card on a Stripe payment form is a common one that I use because I hate typing 4242 over and again.
Yeah, oftentimes if I can't remember like a mnemonic for a keyboard shortcut in VS Code or anything, or I just don't like the shortcut, I'll just reassign it to Hyper, the thing that sticks in my brain the most, just as a way to, personally get a little bit more attached to my keyboard shortcuts. If you had to start coding from scratch today, given what you know about your AI tools and everything like that, what would you choose to work on as a programmer?
That's an interesting question. I guess I'll say something. I don't know how you'll take it, but I would just work on whatever was interesting. That's what I've done my whole career. I haven't had any like long-term strategy or plan. I just worked on the stuff that I thought was cool at any given time. And I went through lots of phases of like trying to learn stuff I should learn, like picking up a book on networking or whatever, or like taking a Coursera class on something. But basically every time I ever did that, I ended up being really frustrated and dropping it pretty quickly. So I just learn what I need to get a project done. And I try to pick projects that that will push me in like at least some new direction where I'll have to learn something that I didn't know before. I was just like, go with what's interesting.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah, that's largely how both Wes and I have gotten to where we are in our development careers, you know?
Yeah. It's honestly such good advice is that like people always try to lay out these massive roadmaps for web developers and say like, you got to learn X, Y, and Z. And you learn so much more by being curious and having fun and building shit that is cool than you would doing literally anything else. Obviously you have to learn the stuff along the ways and there's some fundamentals there, but there's something to be said for just focusing on what you're interested in.
One thing I do try to do though is learn things quite deeply. So if I'm like using a language that, like when I started using React for the first time, I went and like bought a couple of books and actually like read them thoroughly. Or like when I had to build a front end for the first time, I actually wrote it in vanilla JS first to learn what that actually is like before bumping up to like TypeScript and React. And I do think that you get a lot of mileage out of understanding the tools that you're working with and the stack that you're on a level or two deeper than like the surface. And I feel like that's a mistake that I see a lot of beginning programmers make. Like they're very eager to like build the finished product or build the demo. And then they don't take the time to like learn things deeply.
Yeah. I definitely see that a ton because Wes and I, we both teach essentially programming for a living. That's like been our career for a long time. And being able to always make sure people are aware of what's going on beneath the surface, even beneath that surface, usually provides more context, more understanding. People aren't going to be hitting an error message and being like, what the hell do I do now? I got an error. It doesn't work. Well, do you have any tips for learning things deeply? Just you find documentation, you find the books and you read, you just stick your mind to it? Or do you have any tips?
The big thing that I try to do is not have anything that I'm like staring at regularly that I don't know what it is or understand. And if you're not actively trying to do this, your life will just be full of stuff you don't understand. Like, you know, if you're reading like a fiction book and there's a word you don't know, your brain sort of just like glosses over it. That's not a big deal. That's not what I'm talking about. But in like a computer program that you're editing, if there's like a concept or some class or some import or something or some like little bit of syntax and you have maybe a guess, but you don't really know what it is, actually just like taking the time to dig in and like really nail down your understanding of that thing. That's like, I'd say the biggest thing that I personally really lean on. And I find that it has this compounding effect because if you actually understand every character in the file, like every line of code, and you really, really understand what it does, then it compounds like the mental model that you're building of the program. Like that mental model is just going to be a lot stronger. And it's like building that understanding of those individual concepts that are making the thing up as well. So yeah, that's like the main tip that I would.
That's fantastic advice. All right. Last thing we'll do here. We want a shameless plug for you.
Shameless plug. Plugins. Everyone should go try plugins.
Awesome. I've played with it a little bit here and there, but definitely going to check it out a little bit more after this. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate all your time and insights into this. It's fantastic.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right. Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.